Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
Hello, this is August 2009's edition of the Chemistry World Podcast with Bibiana Campaseo, Matt Wilkinson and Nina Notman. In this month's show, why urine might be about to shoot up in value, at least as a fuel source.
Geraldine Botter of Ohio University has discovered a way of taking the urea from urine and turning that into hydrogen we can use as a fuel. She's developed an electrolytic process that uses a nickel-based cathode, which breaks the nitrogen-hydrogen bonds of the urea, which are much weaker than those of the hydrogen-oxygen bonds in water.
That's Matt on the urea cat. And he'll be telling us how that works in just a moment. Also on the way, keeping chemicals captive for both their safety and ours.
The molecular cage is a self-assembly system, and it basically encapsulates small hydrophobic molecules. So what the researchers realized was that white phosphorus was not only hydrophobic, but also it has the perfect size and the perfect shape to fit within the cage, because white phosphorus is tetrahedral, so it fits completely perfectly there.
That's a new generation of molecular cages that can safely lock away things like phosphorus. Plus, we'll also be hearing how cutting down calories leads to longevity.
Yes, on a chronic basis, if you feed an animal a smaller number of calories per day, you don't starve it, but if you restrict the energy intake, then you find that the animal will live markedly longer, or even 40% longer.
Well, that's me stuff then, and quite literally too. Hello, I'm Chris Smith. Welcome to Chemistry World.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.
First this month, you've heard of money going down the drain, but now read fuel too, because scientists have found a way to turn P into H. Tell us more, Matt.
Well, Geraldine Botter of Ohio University has discovered a way of taking the urea from urine and turning that into hydrogen that we can use as a fuel.
How?
Well, she's developed an electrolytic process that uses a nickel-based cathode, which breaks the nitrogen-hydrogen bonds of the urea, which are much weaker than those of the hydrogen-oxygen bonds in water, which is the current way of trying to produce hydrogen electrolytically.
So talk us through it. You collect some urine or something with urea in it. You put some electrodes into this solution. I mean, how does this process actually work in order to get the hydrogen off?
As you say, you take the urine, put some potassium hydroxide in the cell, you place a cathode and an anode. The cathode is made from this special nickel-based whizzy catalyst, as they call it. You apply a voltage across the cell, and this voltage only needs to be 0.37 volts rather than the 1.23 volts needed to electrolytically cleave water. And what happens is that the cathode, the urea, binds to the nickel catalyst. The hydrogen-nitrogen bonds are broken. The hydrogen is released at the cathode, and at the anode, nitrogen is evolved, and the carbon monoxide that's released is actually mopped up by the potassium hydroxide and forms potassium carbonate.
And is this energetically worth doing? In other words, the voltage you have to apply, the current, the energy you're putting in, it's worth doing that for the hydrogen that comes out?
I believe so. And even if it wasn't, there's actually a matter of public health here as well, because one of the biggest waste streams from humans is actually our urine. And this can then degrade by bacteria quite quickly into ammonia, which through various processes eventually gets released into the atmosphere and forms some particulate pollutants such as ammonium sulfate. And these then cause a myriad of health problems such as asthma, bronchitis and even premature death.
So this is a way you're advocating of solving that pollution problem, but at the same time getting something back. So would this be done locally, or are you saying we would plumb something like this in at a sewage works?
Well, actually, you'd probably want to do this locally. Otherwise, if you did it at a sewage works, bacteria would have had chance to actually degrade the sample beforehand, and you would already have released quite a lot of the particulates into the air anyway. As Bruce Logan, an expert in energy generation and wastewater at Pennsylvania State University, says, it's a fantastic way of producing hydrogen. However, he does say that it's still a good idea to start saving up our urine. And I quote, you have to remember about the P in P, and here he's talking about phosphorus. Globally, we need to start thinking about conserving phosphorus for use as fertilizer, because just like oil, one day the deposits are all going to run out and we need to start building phosphorus recycling into our infrastructure.
So homemade hydrogen, perhaps. Thank you, Matt. Now, Bibi, talking about the question of waste and what to do with it, the dye industry is also a problem.
Yes, it is. It is a source of environmental concern, especially in countries like China, where about 1.6 billion tons of dye-containing wastewater are produced every year.
It's a lot.
It is a lot, yes, and it is perhaps because of this reason that a team of Chinese researchers at the South Central University for Nationalities in Wuhan have teamed up with a team from the US, from the Colorado School of Mines, and they have come up with a cheap and recyclable cleaning system.
How does it work?
It involves metal oxides. Basically, they have devised a system that has or that includes nickel oxide nano layers that are only a few nanometers thin, and basically they absorb the dyes like a sponge would, compared to the conventional methods, which are now involved using filtration with activated carbon. The regeneration of activated carbon is quite challenging, and once used, generally it is disposed of in landfills. So this seems like a really nice environmental method.
So once the dye has bound onto this surface, these nano sheets, what actually happens to the dye molecules then? How do you get them back or get them off and make sure they're not a sort of environmental problem?
Basically, what you do is you just destroy them by heating the system up. They suggest temperatures of about 500 degrees in just a normal oven, and that destroys the dye molecules completely.
But it doesn't damage your collection layer, your series of nano layers that trap the particles?
It doesn't at all. It's completely reusable. They're doing studies now on trying to determine how many cycles of absorption and desorption it can take, and also what would be the best metals to use. And although this research hasn't been published yet, they have submitted an article where they suggest that magnesium is even better than nickel at performing this cleaning of the wastewater.
So the dye industry is going greener. Thanks, Bibi. And now to an age-old question of, well, why we get older. Brian Merry.
My work really has been to look at this complex problem by using an animal model whereby we can retard the rate of aging and the incidence of age-related disease. And this has been called various names, been called diet restriction or caloric restriction when people thought that was the reason why diet affected the rate of aging, food restriction. So it's had many different names.
But the bottom line is you feed someone less, you feed an animal less and it lives longer.
Yes, on a chronic basis, if you feed an animal a smaller number of calories per day, you don't starve it, but if you restrict the energy intake, then you find that the animal will live markedly longer, or even 40% longer.
Cynics would say that regardless of whether it extends lifetime, it feels like you're living forever because you're so hungry all the time, life seems to go on forever. But what do you think the mechanism is that cutting down the calories actually leads to in order to prolong life?
Well, again, I have to say, we're not certain about this. I mean, the model was first demonstrated in a mammal in as early as 1935 to 1939. And people like myself are still working on it to try and work out what the underlying mechanisms are. The most popular one, the one for which there is most evidence so far, is the oxidative stress or damage theory of aging. But again, there's controversy about this theory, and there are some items of data which just don't substantiate this theory.
First of all, tell us, what actually is that theory?
Okay, the idea behind the theory is that as you use oxygen to oxidize foodstuffs in cells to generate energy so an animal can live, a byproduct of that is to produce what are called damaging free radicals, which can then interact with the DNA to produce oxidative damage or mutations. They can damage proteins, and they can damage lipids. Now, there are a lot of defense mechanisms in cells to reduce these to harmless compounds, such as water, or to repair the damage, but not all of it can be repaired. Not all of it can be removed from the cells, and you get a slow accumulation of damage within the cells, which impairs their efficiency and eventually leads to what we call aging.
It's ironic to think that we actually are damaging ourselves through our metabolism.
That's the idea, yes. The very fact that you use a very toxic element, oxygen, to maintain life is in itself damaging.
Is it just because we don't have a choice about that? Why have we not evolved to have a better way of handling this very toxic stuff that we rely on for life?
Well, because natural selection and evolution isn't directed towards a particular aim, the reason that we can use the efficient process of oxidative phosphorylation, which is what mitochondria do when they use oxygen to extract energy from foodstuffs, really goes back to the fact that the first cells of our type, what are called eukaryotic cells, produced a symbiotic relationship with a bacteria which could use oxygen in its metabolism. Before, we had a reductive environment and organisms didn't use oxygen until oxygen was produced by bacteria in sufficient quantities. And so we have this symbiotic relationship. The mitochondrion cells were thought to originally to be free-living bacteria. And through 3 billion years of evolution, we've come together to be a symbiotic relationship.
This is the proposal of Lynn Margulis, isn't it, who suggested this endosymbiont theory. But given what we now know about how mitochondria work, does this inform our understanding of why they produce these molecules and whether it's possible to stop them doing that?
We can understand quite a bit about the bioenergetics, about how they produce these free radicals, but we can't stop them doing it, and it wouldn't be a good idea to stop them doing it, because some of these free radicals at low doses are used in the signaling processes both within and between cells. It's a dose relationship. A small amount of free radicals are a good thing, a large amount are a bad thing, and that is difficult to control.
Is it not possible, given that you're saying that mitochondria come from bacteria, or were bacteria once, that we have drugs that would target specifically bacteria, therefore could target mitochondria? Is it not possible to deliver some drug that will soak up some of these harmful species and only do that at the site of the mitochondrion to avoid precisely the problems with signalling that you're talking about?
Well, people have tried a whole range of antioxidants to try and soak up the free radicals. You don't want to interfere with the functioning of the mitochondria, otherwise you'll end up with no energy, you'll kill the organism, kill the cell. But people have tried to soak up the antioxidants, but without much success on survival profiles in mammals.
So what do you think that the big questions are then that people like you need to answer in order to come up with a pill which I'm going to be able to pop to keep me looking young and fresh as I do now?
Well, that doesn't answer the question whether that would be a good idea, but I mean, from
well, assuming people are less nefarious and better looking than me, what do you think the big questions are?
I think if we're going to pursue the oxidative stress theory, we understand quite a bit about how free radicals are produced from mitochondria. What is less certain is what is the target of these free radicals that actually determines the rate of aging. We know that free radicals can cause a range of age-related disease, and there's much more understanding about disease processes than about the actual rate of aging. I think that's the big question at the moment. If this theory is to hold up, what is the rate-limiting target that these free radicals are hitting?
Let's hope they find out soon. That's Brian Merry, who works on the chemistry of the aging process at the University of Liverpool. This is the Chemistry World podcast with me, Chris Smith. And still to come, a way to combat weight gain and how many water molecules does it take to make an acid? The answer's 4, and we'll hear how German scientists have sussed that out in just a moment. But first, Bibi, chemists have come up with a clever way to tame white phosphorus, P4.
White phosphorus is a very nasty element and it's very difficult to keep under control, let's say. So Jonathan Nitschke from the University of Cambridge, in collaboration with researchers at the University of Jyväskylä in Finland, they have devised a method of actually storing it using molecular cages.
Tell us the anatomy of the molecular cage. How does it work? What is it?
The molecular cage is a self-assembly system that uses ions held together by organic linkers, and it basically encapsulates small hydrophobic molecules. So what the researchers realized was that white phosphorus was not only hydrophobic, but also it has the perfect size and the perfect shape to fit within the cage, because white phosphorus is tetrahedral, so it fits completely perfectly there.
So how would you use these cages, and how does the phosphorus get inside the cage if it then can't get out again?
Well, it can get out again. You can actually flood it out with benzene. It will push it out and occupy that space there. And basically, it just assembles like that in water. So you only have to have phosphorus and then the organic frame or components, and it assembles.
So you'd use this, say someone had spilt some phosphorus or you wanted a way of storing it safely. You add these molecular cages to the phosphorus. The phosphorus, the P4, gets inside the cage and is therefore sequestered. Why can't it, if I dry it out, just react with oxygen in the air anyway and catch fire like it normally does, or poison somebody?
It doesn't react with oxygen because it is such a perfect fit that oxygen is not allowed within that cavity, and that stops the phosphorus from reacting. If it actually were to react with oxygen, that would involve a change in volume. And because the cage cannot accommodate that increase in volume, the phosphorus simply stays there for in excess of 4 months so far.
And how do the researchers say that this could actually be used?
Exactly that. They talk about storage and clean-up of spillages. So they are looking to use this sort of system for soaking up harmful chemicals from the environment, potentially in the future.
Thank you, Bibi. Well, from one thing that's harmful, phosphorus, to another that's very bad for you, and that's eating too many cakes and pies and becoming fat, Nina. Not that you're fat, but what I'm saying is that you may have a story about ways in which we might in the future be able to sort the problem out.
Yes, US researchers have developed a synthetic peptide which has helped obese mice slim down. So this synthetic peptide simultaneously mimics the behaviour of two naturally occurring peptides, and it caused some pretty amazing weight losses. So within 1 week of this peptide being injected, the mice have lost 25% of their body weight and 42% of their body fat.
Well, that's quite a lot. How? Presumably they weren't dead.
No, because the peptide is having combined effect to suppress their appetite and also allow them to burn more calories. So the peptide has key features from two naturally occurring hormones, which are glucagon and glucagon-like peptide 1. So these are both known to suppress appetite, but generally they cause problems because glucagon increases our blood glucose levels to dangerous levels, and glucagon-like peptide 1 decreases our blood glucose levels. So these researchers at Indiana University decided to find out what happened if you administered the two together. So the peptide has key features of both of these hormones, and with a few tweaks they found out they had full potency at both of the receptors.
Oh, right, I get it. So you have a protein that looks in the same molecule like these two individual components, the glucagon and the glucagon-like peptide. So it does both jobs in one molecule, and therefore you've got one thing offsetting the high blood sugar effect and another offsetting the appetite-boosting effect, and as a result you both burn more energy, plus you eat less, so you lose weight.
Exactly. So they're now looking to see if they can convert this into a human obesity treatment, but first off they need to see if the mechanism's working primates.
Indeed. But of course the good news is that we have both of those hormone signals working in us the same way they do in a mouse, which is kind of encouraging because it suggests it should work.
I certainly hope so.
Yeah, then you'll be able to afford a few more pints and pies.
Yeah.
Thank you, Nina. Nina Notman. And now to what's increasingly becoming a dying art. Glassblower, now turned local councillor, Graham Reid.
Technically, the discipline of which I have so much experience is scientific lamp working. And that is because we work with preformed glass tube or rod and occasionally sheet. And we reform the glass using flames and mechanical devices like glass blowing lathes to turn big pieces of tubing. And in reheating the glass, we can then shape it by blowing the glass using a closed vessel with a single outlet, or we can spin the glass centrifugally, or we can slump the glass using gravity.
So you're not one of these red-cheeked blokes who had
indeed
a lump of
not,
glass on
no.
the end of a long tube. It's the
absolutely
one thing.
Not.
It's the one thing, though, that really defines a chemistry laboratory, isn't it? These amazing, intricate bits of glassware.
Absolutely.
How did you get into making those sorts of things in the first place?
Well, as a school leaver, I was working as a science technician in one of the Union Carbide's factories in Hampshire, and my long-term interest in glass from my schoolboy days, when I used to play with a Bunsen burner and tubes in a local chemist shop, I discovered there was a glass-blowing factory or a glass-blowing department in a Mullard factory in Southampton, and I did an apprenticeship. And since then, I've been working in Australasia and England and Scotland over 30-odd years.
And universities pretty much universally had someone with your sorts of skills in order to make their experiments possible.
At one stage, what was then 44 universities in Britain, every university had a science department, and invariably that meant a glassblower in a workshop, yes.
And the most intriguing, difficult and intense bit of glassblowing you ever had to do?
Triple-layer jacketed vessels are certainly a challenge. That's where you have a working vessel acting as a reactor. Could be 2 litres, could be 5, 10 litres. And then you have a jacket round it with water going between the two layers to cool it. But in some cases, the chemistry requires working at cryogenic temperatures, maybe down to minus 100, 150 centigrade, in which case a third layer is put round the glass, and that then becomes a vacuum jacket to prevent condensation of atmospheric moisture.
So given that it took someone with your skill set to make that kind of apparatus, why are universities all over the UK not replacing people like you when they retire?
Largely budgetary pressures within universities, the luxury of individual faculties having their own complete set of technicians has disappeared with the budgetary pressures. And the effect has been to privatise the marketplace so that people who were university glassblowers have now effectively gone into self-employed business and then become subcontractors to the universities. And it's only the biggest universities with the biggest and the best science departments that still have any glassblowing presence.
Doesn't sound very cost-effective, but presumably that's exactly what you did, isn't it? Because you set up your own operation.
Absolutely, yes. In 1998, I left Stirling University after 4 years of running a semi-commercial business where I was gaining enough income from outside work to pay for my own salary and overheads while still providing an internal service. But the university wanted the workshop space more than they wanted me, and I was encouraged to leave and set up a subcontract business providing glassblowing to university and then working into the local business and science community.
Is there a big demand outside university for the kind of skills that you have?
It's become increasingly more specialised and regionalised. In the period I ran my own business, which I called Scotia Glass Technology, I had 7 or 8 school leavers come through me. 2 of those gents now run a business called Scott Glass, where they're carrying on the tradition of what I did up until 2002.
Who are the major customers, though?
Very much pharmaceutical-based. The big names like GlaxoSmithKline, Avecia, and other such companies. The trouble with the marketplace is that these companies are often going through buyouts and phoenix-like regeneration, so the names keep changing. But the pharmaceutical industry, with its very strong investment in drug research, is probably the area with the biggest budgets.
So why have you eschewed glassblowing in favour of politics?
Well, I decided to sell my business after 16 years, partly because of almost mental exhaustion, although in between I was busy doing a degree in politics and a number of social activities. But I got to the point where I wanted a change. And when I sold the business, I actually invested in micro wind renewable energy and acted as a consultant for a company for about 6 or 7 years. Ending up in politics was really as much the fact that the proportional representation in Scotland has given minor parties a bigger say in local government.
From reaction vessel maker to political reactionary, that was Graham Reid recounting his experience of professional glassblowing. And now to an incredible feat of chemistry in which scientists have answered a fundamental question about the behaviour of acids. So Matt, tell us more.
Well, basically, what they've done is they've found the smallest number of water molecules needed to dissociate the hydrogen and the chloride, so the strongest HCl droplet that you could ever find, or the most acidic HCl droplet you can ever make. And actually, all it takes is 4 water molecules.
So what we're getting at here is you have HCl, hydrogen chloride. When you put that near water, it ionises. It turns into H+ and Cl-. That's why it's acidic. But the big question is, well, how many water molecules is it going to take in
exactly.
order to stabilise that? And you're saying just 4?
Yeah.
Per molecule of HCl?
Yeah.
How on earth do you work that out? I don't mean you personally, but how would someone do that? I mean, that's incredible.
Well, it's It's actually a stunning feat of small-scale chemistry, if you've ever seen one. Martina Havenith and colleagues at the Ruhr University in Bochum in Germany took helium at high pressure and injected that into a very high vacuum. So this forms droplets of helium in the vacuum. And then they can slowly inject water and HCl into that system. And basically the helium droplets run around the cage like a Hoover and pick up the molecules that have been sucked in.
So you get molecules of water or hydrogen chloride inside the droplets of helium?
Indeed, yes. And what's even more intriguing is that actually that inside these droplets, it's actually about 0.37 degrees Kelvin, and so it's almost at absolute freezing.
Actually, how do you know what's going on inside those tiny droplets? How do they see the molecules of water and the hydrogen chloride in order to know exactly what's going on?
Well, they studied them using a laser-based infrared spectroscopy technique. And what's amazing is this process actually occurs at all, that any reaction happens, because every reaction has a thermal energy barrier. And at these sort of temperatures of near absolute zero, nothing usually should happen.
So tell us what does actually happen then. So when you get the critical number of water molecules, presumably that's when the reaction kicks in.
It is indeed. If you've just got three water molecules and an HCl molecule, they just sit there and they just stabilise the charges with dipole moments and things like that. You add the fourth one in there, and what actually happens is the hydrogen is taken from the chlorine. The three water molecules sit around with the lone pairs on the oxygen atoms pointing at the positively charged hydrogen atoms. And the chloride ion is then sat at the opposite side of, shall we say, the base of a tetrahedron, stabilising the charge from the hydrogen atoms on the water molecules that are stabilising the hydronium ion.
Absolutely fascinating. Thank you very much, Matt. So from the very cold to the very warm, potentially, Nina, this is interesting. We've always thought of sulphur as our friend when it comes to global warming. It helps to beam some of the sun's energy back off into space. But now you're going to tell us that, in fact, it could not be quite so good. After all, it might be a poison chalice.
It seems so. So, sulfate and nitrate particles in the atmosphere we've always thought would help us combat global warming because they reflect sunlight. But it turns out that when they're combined with soot particles from car exhaust, etc., they actually make things worse.
Why should that happen? Why should you see particles being warmer if they've got sulfur associated with them?
So we know that soot absorbs solar energy and enhances our warming effects, and the nitrate and the sulfate forms a coating around the soot particles, which acts like a lens, and this directs even more sunlight within the soot particles, and they found that it increases the amount of light that goes into the soot by 1.6 times.
And therefore, consequently, presumably the temperature.
That's right, Chris. So they've been using quite a cool technique to do this. It's an aerosol time-of-flight mass spectrometer. So the samples are pulled directly from the atmosphere into the machine. There's no kind of sample taking, so they get immediate results. And this is one of the few machines that exists out there at the moment. The other thing to say is that they've been doing their samples in quite polluted areas, so Riverside in California and Mexico City, so we don't know yet whether the similar effects would be seen in more pristine environments.
So if you just get sulfur going up into the atmosphere, it's probably still our friend. It still probably, as a sulfate, will reflect infrared energy out into space. But when it co-associates with particles of soot, that's when there could be a problem.
Indeed, and the researchers are saying that it might not just be soot. There might be other cases where sulfate, which we believe to be our friend, is indeed not. So we need to do much more research in this area.
Because weren't some people suggesting that one way to combat the problem of global warming is to shove a whole load of sulfur derivatives into the atmosphere where they would have this reflective effect? If this is true, what you're saying, and on the grand scale, then that could have a very detrimental effect.
It could have a very detrimental effect. The researchers do say that when they're talking about putting sulfur into the atmosphere, they're talking about the stratosphere, and there isn't actually that much soot that makes it up that far. But yes, that's certainly something that we should be considering.
And also, what goes up might come down. So even if you did put it up really high, presumably it could come back down again and then reassociate with the soot. Or does that only happen when burning takes place at ground level?
No, that could be a problem. That's something that should definitely be considered.
So every cloud doesn't necessarily have a silver lining. Thank you, Nina. Right, that's pretty much it for this month. But before we go, we'd better catch up with the answer to the chemical conundrum. So remind us of the question, Nina.
What we wanted to know was, what did British scientist William Byrd Herapath discover in 1852 when he added a tincture of iodine to the urine of dogs that had been fed quinine?
And the answer was herapathite. a crystalline material that's been used to make Polaroid, the material used in sunglasses, camera filters and numerous other optical devices. Herapath noticed that when transparent needle-like crystals of herapathite were laid on top of one another at right angles, the overlapping portions became black as midnight. Many dogs will probably be quite happy about this, that fortunately modern Polaroid is made from polymers such as polyvinyl alcohol and not from dog urine.
So the winner is Ben Clough from Pendant in Cornwall, who wins a Chemistry World goodie bag.
And so for this month, to mark the 40th anniversary of the first landing on the Man of the Moon, our question is this. Thanks to data collected by the Apollo and other space missions, we know that the Moon was most likely formed when Earth and another planet collided as the solar system was forming, which fired molten mantle material into orbit around the Earth. But what was the key bit of data collected by these moon missions that backs up this theory? If you want a hint, you can read the feature on the history of Apollo missions in August's Chemistry World. And when you have the answer, send it in to us at chemistryworld@rsc.org. And please remember to include your name and address so we can send the lucky winner the goodie bag.
Thank you, Matt. And you can also use that address to send us your thoughts, feedback or suggestions for future episodes of Chemistry World. For now, it remains for me to say that we'll be back reacting to more exciting chemistry next month. But in the meantime, don't forget that there's also our weekly podcast, Chemistry in Its Element, where we take a look at the sinister side of the periodic table. You can tune into Chemistry in Its Element via iTunes or on our website, where the address is chemistryworld.org/elements. Chemistry World this month was brought to you by Bibiana Campasejo, Matt Wilkinson and Nina Notman. I'm Chris Smith from thenakedscientist.com. Until next time, goodbye.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.